The retirement and IRA show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, hello, and welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition for this week. This is, in fact, the first Q&A show during June of 2025, so we are into National Annuity Awareness Month. If you listened to our EDU show a couple days ago, we started talking annuities then. But in honor of National Annuity Awareness Month, we kind of emphasize annuities on our shows during this month. Today we're going to do that, the Q&A show. Although for you non-annuity interested, if that's a classification of listeners, we'll always throw in at least one non-annuity question. And then we'll always do our Social Security, which some may not think of it as such, but Social Security is appropriate to talk about during National Annuity Awareness Month because it is a form of an annuity, right? It's a lifetime stream of income coming in from a deep-pocketed third party, looks and squawks and acts like an annuity. So we'll always do our Social Security questions, which is, I'm sure, today where we will start when Jim joins us here. Whenever he's ready, we can dive in. I'm sure he's assembling last-minute annuity questions, deciding. I know he has plenty to go through, but he's getting them lined up for us to tackle today, after we get through our Social Security question or two. So, Jim, welcome to the Q&A show.
Thank you, Chris, and welcome everybody to another episode of the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition, where you have the Q's and we have the A's. So hopefully we have the A's. All righty. I know on this show we are going to have a couple of Social Security questions, one non-Social Security question, and the non-Social Security question, if all goes well, will be answered by one of the juniors. Most likely Jacob will be joining us on the show to answer the non-annuity question. And then we're going to have a couple of annuity-related questions, again, in honor of National Annuity Awareness Month. And I'm also going to put on hold, for this episode at least, the Social Security questions and the involvement of ChatGPT as I decide what I'm going to do. I received one, I would put it as a nasty gram from a listener because she was a little bit, in my opinion, rude in the email. But I appreciated her sharing her distaste of any banter whatsoever between Chris and I, not just the trivia with Chris and ChatGPT. But another listener wrote, also doesn't like the ChatGPT. And the only thing that I'm going to share on all of that, folks, one of the reasons I decided to use or bring in the ChatGPT, if you will, is because I am thoroughly impressed, but also thoroughly confused and nervous about where AI is going in today's society, how it's going to affect not only my firm, but my life as a retiree and life in society in general. And I am not kidding. I subscribe to a certain newsletter. I won't say what it is, but it talks about all things AI. And today, one of my alerts from the Wall Street Journal matched an alert that came in from this newsletter as well, where the Anthropic CEO is predicting that AI is going to threaten job extinction within the next 5 years. And not the low-hanging fruit jobs that you think of. And that this CEO of a very, very successful large language model AI company is predicting that unemployment could exceed 20% in as little as 5 years because society has no idea how many jobs are going to be replaced by AI. And he specifically was talking coding in his industry will probably predominantly be done by AI in 5 years.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting thought. Just hopefully we won't go too deep on this tangent here. And Jacob's available, so I'm going to let him come in. Here we can.
But why I'm trying to.
What I wanted to mention is I've thought about this a lot too. And what I'm concerned about is remember the whole, I mean, you and I are of the age and most of our listeners where we saw automation in factories with robots, et cetera, taking jobs, essentially replacing humans. Cause a robot doesn't need a salary. It costs money to obtain it, but it doesn't need to eat, doesn't need to take a break. It's, you know, all the things, you know, robots are known for. And it replaced a lot of these robots replaced a lot of manual labor. And where I see AI though, it's replacing a lot of intellectual labor, which is the scary part because we usually see manual labor jobs like working in a restaurant or working at a store or digging a ditch or doing carpentry or things like that as quote lower level jobs. That's just, I'm not making that judgment. I have great respect for people who have any kind of job, including all those jobs. And we need those types of, I guess you might call them service jobs, if you will. But AI isn't going to replace that. They're not going to be the bartender, right? That you have a nice chat with while they mix you a drink where you are looking for human interaction. They're not going to replace that, but they're going to replace people that are doing a lot of highly valuable work today in the form of sitting at their computer doing stuff. Well, if you're sitting there at a computer as a human typing on your keyboard doing stuff, AI can do it inside the computer faster and maybe better once it learns the ropes than you can, and your job is the one. So a lot of these highly paid, more technical jobs, actually, in my mind, I'm scared those are at risk. And that'll be a fundamental change in our society. So again, I don't want to drag us too far. This could be a whole show of just going back and forth on threats
of AI. It could be, Chris, but I wanted to start involving ChatGPT because I'm impressed with it. I understand its limitations right now. It's only 2 years old. It's not even 2 years old. It's new. But it's in its infancy. But I have had some amazing chats with my personal subscription to ChatGPT, especially on history, because I love history and I won't bore everybody with them. But I've been totally impressed. One of the things that I have done is created a chat thread where I take verbiage from the history books I'm reading. Right now I'm reading a lot of history books on the settlement of Ohio for various reasons. Everybody knows I want to move there. And some of the wars that were being fought amongst the white settlers and the Native Americans who were being unfortunately forced out. And the after-action reports of junior officers to senior officers, those have all been preserved. And in this one book that I'm reading, they're in there. And they're written in English, but in a way that sometimes I don't know what they're saying. And I have created a thread in ChatGPT where I copy verbatim from my Kindle right into the chat. And the chat verbalizes the after-action report the way a modern-day junior officer would write an after-action report to a senior officer. And it's amazing. It is so cool. But not only that, Chad has gone into deep education of me of why the way they wrote back then was dramatically different than the way they likely spoke when they were in a tavern or work in a field together. And it went on to explain to me how two friends might have said the exact same thing in this after action report, but most likely how they sounded when they were talking and why it was different, because education was so specialized back then in the 1700s. And they wrote more after with a Latin knowledge. I mean, Chat was just explaining all this to me of why it's like that. My point is, it was fairly incredible what it got me to do. And I'm trying to get people to understand how life is going to change, even for retirees. And you don't want to be that 70, 75, 80-year-old person in the middle of a store who doesn't understand AI, where it's all around them and is slowing everything up and you can't keep up with it. I ignored social media, and I'm proud that I have. I don't even know what Facebook is. I don't know how to log into it. I don't know what an Instagram is. My closest to social media that I have is I now have a subscription to YouTube because I find how to do things. I love to shoot, as y'all know. One of the best ways to know how to clean some of the firearms I have is to just watch videos of other people doing it. And I got sick of the ads, so I paid $100-something and I get YouTube. I think that's social media. I have no freaking idea. But I now have a subscription to YouTube. I don't want to be that fool with AI. And as a business owner, and I'm not going to share it now because Chris is right, we could go on forever. I bought a few AI programs in for the firm that has dramatically improved our efficiency and easily replaced interns. Easily. And that is the low-hanging fruit. So why I am involving ChatGPT in the questions with Chris was to hopefully get people to understand, holy moly, this freaking thing is amazing. I've got to learn this. Not to say, oh, these guys are wasting my freaking time. I only want to listen to them talk about retirement. I've been doing retirement planning, folks, for 26 years. I do it day in and day out, weekends, nights, evenings. I've got no life. You all know, I have no kids, no wife. Everybody here has probably, here, Chris and Jacob, have received emails from me at 11, 12 o'clock at night. I never stop eating, drinking, thinking, and breathing. This is what gives my life purpose. So do you think I want to do a podcast where I don't have fun? Where I don't talk to you as humans? And get you to understand me as a person, not some knowledgeable person on IRAs and retirement who created the fun number approach to retirement planning. But Jesus, this guy's real. He nearly died from a stroke. His dad gave him all these ways to look at retirement. He went to BU. He used to be a cop. You get to know me as a person in order to like me and trust me. And if you don't like me, don't listen to me. But that's the whole reason I decided to try to embrace ChatGPT, is to show you guys, and for me myself, to start to learn the capabilities, because you do not want to be left behind this curve. Read what Anthropic's CEO said today. Read the news reports out there. This guy's on to something. And it's going to greatly change society. And you all can't be left behind. So that's why I did it. So for all you people who are all upset, kind of look at the bigger picture. And also say to yourselves every now and then, God, yeah, Jim, he's a person. Let's let him have a little bit of fun. He's doing this for free. He's been doing this for 16 years now, however long. I don't know. Chris knows. 16, 17 years. Let him have some fun. Okay. With that said, we're going to do, since Jacob is on the podcast now, as I promised, we are going to do one non-annuity-related question a week for all of you people who don't like annuities or want to keep learning other things. And I wanted Jacob to come on because this ties specifically into the email question we received last week on the show, where someone was asking, hey, if I buy one of these defined maturity, well, she just said ETFs. In the subject line, it was a defined maturity ETF, but in the body of the email, she never made that clear.
Yeah, I think it might have even said defined outcome, but it was
defined outcome. Yeah. Yes. And what she was asking is, hey, if I put money in a bond ETF and interest rates go from 4% to 7%, can I lose money? And I wanted her to understand that yes and no. If you are talking, I call them open-ended. Now, a true person who understands mutual funds will understand what an open-ended mutual fund is. I'm not talking about open-ended in the sense of an open-ended mutual fund. I'm talking open-ended in the sense of a bond fund, like I think it was Chris we mentioned on the show, BND, some Vanguard right. intermediate term bond fund. A bond fund that does not mature at a stated period of time and pay out all the money, but a bond fund that is open-ended in the sense it's going to keep buying new bonds. There's no stated maturity date. It's going to have long-term bonds, short-term bonds, intermediate bonds. And you're just buying a diversified, ongoing, or open-ended bond fund. And I explained that, yes, if interest rates go up, and Chris and I gave the reasons why, the price of your bonds are going to go down. And if you have a bond fund that doesn't mature at a stated period, and I think these bond funds are fine, they're wonderful, they're beautiful during the accumulation phase. Not so much in the transition and distribution phase. And we use them quite regularly in our models in the accumulation phase. But we tend not to use them in the distribution phase. There's a couple of clients in the distribution phase who will have them for various reasons. But for the most part, in the distribution phase, we embrace individual bonds, multi-year guaranteed annuities. Have to give my annuity shout out here on National Annuity Awareness Month. And we might use brokered CDs. But we will also use a type of ETF that is designed more like a bond that you own. Because if you own the bond itself and you hold it to maturity, and I'm talking government bonds, I'm not getting into high yield bonds, otherwise known as junk bonds. I'm not getting into corporate bonds. I'm not getting into foreign bonds and emerging market bonds. I'm talking U.S. government bonds. If you have a U.S. government bond, I'm not worried about default. I do worry in the future, but not right now. So if you own a U.S. government bond and you hold it till the day it matures, yes, listener, you will get all your money back. Especially if you buy it at treasurydirect.gov at par, new issue, you just buy it, you own it, government has your money. If you have a five-year bond, in 5 years, that bond's going to give you all your money back. And during that five-year period, it's going to pay you out some interest. Now, what you do with that interest is going to be up to you. That's called interest rate risk or reinvestment risk, actually. Now, during that five-year period, if interest rates rise from when you bought the bond on paper, your bond is going to show it's lost money. But if you wait till the fifth year to the day it's going to pay out, that paper loss disappears because the bond will pay out, quote unquote, at par. And assuming you bought a new issue at par, so there's no aftermarket premium bonds or aftermarket discount bonds, I'm talking a premium bond, you'll get all your money back. Very similar to a MIGA, very similar to a CD. So far, so good, Chris?
Yeah, and that's what Perfect. Makes a distinction with one of these, what you termed open-ended bond funds, is they don't have a bunch of bonds that all mature on the same date paying out a par value, which would give you that, quote, kind of form of principal protection, if you will. They've got a whole bunch of mixture that are maturing. They're buying new ones and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So when you go to sell it, you're selling a lot of bonds in that bond fund in the middle of their lifespan, right? Where they're susceptible to being worth more or less due to interest rates. And that's why an open-ended bond fund has the type of principal volatility that holding an individual bond to maturity would not.
Exactly. So let's go to that next. That's why Jacob's on here. I then told this listener last week that, hey, if you are talking specifically about defined maturity bond funds, theoretically or technically, yes, if you hold it till it matures. So those bond funds, and we're not going to mention the sponsor that we use, but I will say that the sponsor we use, and Jacob will correct me if I'm wrong in a second. He is going to talk. Trust me, folks. Jacob will correct me. I believe their bond ETFs mature October 15th. But they tell you the day and the year that it will fully pay out. So they're trying to design an ETF that will have multiple bonds, will solve the interest reinvestment conundrum, which is if you have $10,000 in a bond you own, good luck trying to invest that interest every quarter, every year, every month, however often it's paying out. This ETF solves that. You can just reinvest it right away, right back in. The interest is being reinvested. And it, too, will be put in bonds that will mature and fully pay out by the stated month and year. But I wanted the listener to understand there's some complexity here that is not present with just buying a bond. And that complexity has to do, the bond fund is going to have a portfolio of bonds, some that the manager purchased at a premium, some that the manager purchased at a discount. And if you don't know what that means, start learning. Some that the manager got at par. The ETF itself is subject to fees. The manager's not going to do this for free. The ETF is also subject to the bid-ask spread when you go to buy it. So there's all these factors. You can't rely on a traditional valuation metric to figure out how much you're going to earn. And that the provider we use on their website, and Jacob will explain if you can get it on the retail site or if it only has to be on our site that we get as investment advisors, I'm not sure. They have a different return that's designed to kind of mimic yield to maturity, but addressing all of these complexities, the fees of the ETF, premium bonds, discount bonds, par bonds, bid-ask spread. And I told the listener that if you put money in this ETF and set it to reinvest all of the interest payments out, yes, you should get all your money back. And you should also have earned close to what this yield to maturity, but it's not called yield to maturity number, was based on the NAV, net asset value, of the ETF the second you bought it. And that's why I wanted Jacob to come on. He follows this for the office. And he told me, and I can't even remember, Jacob, what it is. It's the long, long yeah. word. But he will bring you up to date on this quote-unquote yield to maturity, what it looks at, what it's trying to do. And again, unfortunately, folks, I don't feel comfortable telling you who we use because we are licensed investment advisors and we have all this disclosure. So he'll just tell you it is a national provider and if you can get this on the public site or not. So go ahead, Jacob. I set the stage.
Yeah. No, sounds good. There is a good amount of kind of complexity in these products. Like Jim just, spent some time kind of chatting about the key measure that, was missing on the last podcast that I teased Jim about kind of remembering for these, what this provider at least would call estimated net acquisition yield. That's your kind of metric. That's the metric that we're thinking of when Jim mentions kind of the yield to maturity, but it's not technically the yield to maturity. For these kind of defined maturity or defined outcome ETFs on the bond side, it's called an estimated net acquisition yield. And really what that measure is, and I'm taking this directly from the provider's kind of website, is really kind of the average yield to maturity of the bonds inside the actual ETF, adding in the price adjustment, which is the actual NAV movement of the ETF itself, minus the expense ratio of these specific funds. Those are the three kind of key factors that they're building in when they're saying, hey, this is the estimated net acquisition yield. And really what I want the listeners to kind of take away from that is, you know, not let their eyes glaze over when I give you the three kind of factors that make up this long, you know, naming culture, whatever it is. But what I want you to kind of keep in mind is the estimated net acquisition yield, folks, is really just telling you that if I bought this specific fund on this exact moment in time at this specific share price right now, and I had the interest automatically reinvested like I would on any other ETF in my portfolio, I can basically assume or project that somewhere in the ballpark, my annual yield is going to be reflected by this estimated net acquisition yield number. It's never going to be exact because there are so many, you know, different factors at play. And like Jim mentioned, there are bonds that are at premium or discount or some that are at par, depending on the price that you actually buy the ETF at. Obviously, all these factors combine to kind of fluctuate the estimated net acquisition yield on your specific ETF that you buy. The cool thing is on the website that I'm kind of looking at here, and the provider that we like to kind of use for these, I'm on the retail side. So I'm not logged into any special financial professional login or anything like that. So it's my opinion that you should be able to access this on the retail side, folks, if you wanted to do this yourself. But really, you know, you can kind of log into this website or just navigate to this website, pardon me, and look at the different kind of bond funds. In this case, the provider that I'm looking at, the two categories that we like to kind of use, going back to what Jim was saying with, you know, U.S. government bonds, are really some of the ETFs that are tied to just U.S. Treasury bonds, and then some of the bonds that are tied to TIPS, Treasury Inflation Protected Securities, pardon me. Those are the two kind of larger categories that I would say we kind of use internally that are tied to, you know, the U.S. kind of government here. In the provider that I'm kind of picking on right now, on the treasury bond side, they've got funds, folks, that are kind of laddered out all the way through. Gosh, it looks like on the treasury bond side, they've got one listed all the way out through about 2055. They've got one every year for the next 10 or so years to get you through 2035. And then they do have a couple of longer term ones, you know, with the latter term being 2055 here in this specific case. But what's cool, and the reason I mentioned about the website here, is you can actually come in here on the retail side of things and find the, you know, the specific ETF that you were kind of looking for, whether or not you wanted to tie your maturity to, you know, December or October of 2028. And the reason I mentioned those 2 months is on the TIPS side, those will actually mature in October. On the treasury bond side, those will actually mature in December. So there's a little bit of a difference there. The TIPS ones mature a couple months earlier than the treasury bond ones. But you can navigate to the website, folks, and see, you know, hey, I want a bond fund that's going to mature in December of 2028, let's just say. And the website actually allows you to go in there and plug in a share price of whatever, you know, whatever price you think you could purchase that bond at that exact moment in time. And the website will update to reflect what the updated estimated net acquisition yield is going to be based on the current price that you actually plugged into the website. So it's a cool tool because you can kind of see, you know, more realistically, hey, if I were to buy this today, right, at what it's trading for right now, what would my, you know, estimated annual yield kind of be? And that website would be able to show this. But conversely, if you had already owned these funds, let's just say, and you made an initial lot purchase, you know, 6 months or so ago, you could go into whatever your custodian is, you know, UVGs, UFidelity folks, you can go in and get the lot detail and say, hey, okay, in, you know, November of 2024, I bought, you know, 10 shares of this at XYZ price. You can take that price of the initial lot that you bought, go into the website and plug that price in, and it's going to show you based on that initial kind of purchase price for that specific fund, what your unique estimated net acquisition yield is going to be on that fund that you actually own. So the tools are kind of there. There's a lot of complexity built into these funds and how they kind of function, but the tools are kind of there for folks to be able to kind of get a better idea of the ballpark annual yield that you could expect out of one of these funds, assuming that you hold it through the maturity and that you reinvest the interest on these funds. And that applies for both the TIPS offering and the treasury bond offering. The same thing is kind of the case with those two. On the TIPS side, and I don't want to get too into the weeds on it, it's a little bit different, right? Because they have that inflation adjustment that they kind of factor in. Again, the provider that we use, if you're looking at the tip side of things, they will kind of factor in that estimated inflation adjustment as well. So you can kind of get an idea of, hey, including that inflation adjustment, you know, what's kind of the annual yield, that the estimated yield that I'm kind of looking at on this fund. So it's always going to be a ballpark value. It'll never be exact just because, again, these funds own premium, discount, and par bonds all within inside them. And the NAV, the actual share price of the fund, is constantly going to be fluctuating based on current market conditions, right? Whether it's up or down, depending on what interest rates are doing at that exact moment in time. Because those two kind of factors are constantly, you know, going to vary. The expense ratio is always going to stay the same. That's the easy part, I guess, on these, when they take out the expense ratio for the annual amount. But because those other two factors are constantly going to be shifting, you do have to be cognizant and look and see, okay, you know, what is kind of my applicable estimated net acquisition yield? So that's how they kind of function. So, Jim, hopefully that's kind of what you were looking for.
No, excellent. You did excellent. I have one more quick question for you before you leave. But that listener and listeners is the net takeaway, no pun intended, with this net acquisition yield. If you purchase one of these ETFs and hold it for the defined outcome period, very similar to a buffered ETF we talk about all the time, but if you hold it, yes, listener, even if interest rates went from 4 to 7%, you should get all your money back, but you need to reinvest the money, because if there's a lot of premium bonds in the portfolio, they will mature at par. And a premium bond means they were purchased above par. But they were purchased above par because the interest rates were higher than current interest rates. And factoring in those interest rates, the additional interest rate, you're going to come out equal to or ahead of a nominal bond or a par bond. If you don't reinvest these interest payments, it is theoretically possible you would get less principal. But if you added your principal you get and the interest you received, it should equal what you put in and then some, because you are receiving interest. But it's very important people understand, when you buy an aftermarket bond or you buy this ETF that's actively trading, you could get less principal back depending if the bond was at a premium or a discount. But you have to look at the total return, the returned principal and the interest received. So as long as you're reinvesting, and you don't have to reinvest, if you want to take the money out, do recognize you might get a little bit more or a little bit less back. That's all I'm trying to explain, because the ETF portfolio is full of premium bonds and discount bonds and the bid-ask spread. It's important to see what is the ETF worth and what do I have to pay to get it? And you have to make sure your bid-ask spread is reasonable to the net asset value of the bond ETF. Okay, yeah, Jacob.
Go ahead. Yep, sorry. I was just going to piggyback real quick off that. You definitely be cognizant of the bid-ask spread, like Jim was kind of mentioning there. I've seen, you know, in some of the offerings that we've purchased, you know, usually they're pretty substantial trading volume, and the spread on the actual purchases is pretty tight between the bid and the ask. But sometimes you have to be cautious that there are some issues that maybe have recently come out from the provider, or maybe they're just not as popular because they're longer term, something like that, right? That maybe the trading volume isn't as high as you would have seen on some of the others, and that can lead to a higher, you know, bid-ask spread when you go to actually purchase it. So definitely be cautious of that. Utilize, you know, your limit orders. I know all you you VGers are probably comfortable with using the limit orders for things like that. So be cautious of that. The other thing I'll mention too, because Jim, you know, was chatting about it, and it reminded me to kind of touch on it, is another part of the website that I wanted to talk about for the providers that we use here, is you can kind of navigate into any of the ETFs that I was kind of talking about. So any of the, you know, I've been picking on the 2028 one, right? So I can navigate into that 2028 specific fund, at least on the provider that we kind of use. There's a tab that you can look at where you can actually go into the ETF and look at the actual individual holdings inside the fund itself. So it is actually going to go in there and show you the different individual US Treasury bonds in this case that are owned with inside of that ETF. And the reason that that's important, or something to kind of at least kind of keep in mind, is like Jim was just mentioning with the bonds inside the fund that are either trading at a discount or par or at a premium, you can actually come into the website, isolate your specific fund, and go through each of the bonds that that fund actually owns inside it and see what the par value for each of those bonds were, what the market value is, things like that. So you can actually make a determination yourself of, hey, you know, my fund, it owns 20 different individual bonds, right? I'm just making that up as an example. And, you know, 7 of them are premium, 10 of them are par, and 3 of them are a discount. Again, just completely making up those numbers, right? It is going to vary, folks, depending on whichever issue and the timeline that you go with, right? Some of them are going to have more par than others. Some are going to have more premium. Some are going to have more discount. It is going to fluctuate, you know, fund by fund. But the long and the short of it is you could always come in here and get into the weeds if you wanted to and see the actual bond holdings inside the ETF and make a determination for yourself of which ones are actually trading at a discount, which ones are trading at par, and which ones are trading at a premium.
Perfect. Thank you, Jacob. One final thing. What's the fee on this? Is it 10 bips?
Yeah, good question. So I just, on the ones that I'm looking at here on the treasury side, so not the tips ones, the fee on the treasury ones that I'm seeing is about 7 bips, about 0.07%. So very, in our eyes, I would say very reasonable, right? And that's not an advertisement by any means, but reasonable fee for given, you know, the management that they're doing on the back end on these. So the treasury one's about 7 bips. And then on the tips one, it's a little bit more. That one's the one that's at 10 bips.
Okay. So you can see, folks, for the bond ladder and the ability to reinvest all that interest and how that interest will be reinvested into more bonds that are set to mature at that stated period of time, except in the year that it's scheduled to pay out, then the interest is reinvested in a cash-like holding. To have all of that done automatically, and if you're buying nominal treasuries, you're paying 7 bips, that's nothing. I mean, it's something, but it's not expensive. For all the time-saving, automatic reinvestment of the interest, and full liquidity if you need to sell early. Try selling an individual bond early, especially if you're on treasurydirect.gov. Or then you have to deal with selling a bond early with bid-ask spreads and trying to find a bond broker and all this other stuff. Now, granted, most custodians are going to do that for you, but there's a cost associated with that. I think these ETFs play a very key role. You just need to learn about them and understand them, and hopefully Jacob's answer helped. All right, Jacob, we have to get to some annuity-like questions, but thank you very much for coming on, and we'll probably drag you on a couple more times.
All right. Yeah, yeah, sounds good. Enjoy the annuity discussion. I'll see you guys later.
Thanks, Jacob.
Perfect.
Bye now.
All right. Smart little kid, isn't he?
He is. Little kid. He's a full-formed adult.
He's not an adult. I think he's, what, 26 or 27 he turned recently? I got sweaters older than him. That's sad.
I have sweaters older than him.
Ay vey, we're getting old, Chris. All right, let's get to some Social Security questions, which are a form of annuity.
Yep.
Okay, this one came in, I'm guessing, from a long-time listener because they call us Bugs and Cowboy. He says, I'm not sure if you're still challenging ChatGPT, but here's my question. We're going to skip the question right now, listener, and I'm not sure if we're going to keep doing the ChatGPT thing. Let me see if I get any feedback from people. But hopefully, once you guys understand why I did it, you'll be a little more receptive to it. So let's jump right into the question.
I think a modified version of what we've been doing, people would accept. The way we've been doing it is just a little too tedious.
Well, we'll see. I'll see what our listeners say. Okay. To my question, 6 months ago when my wife filed for Social Security benefits, part of the process asked us to mail a copy of our marriage certificate to our local Social Security office so they could link our accounts. They indicated they would return our marriage certificate after this was complete. The application for Social Security processed quickly, and she, the wife, has started receiving benefits. I personally have not applied for mine yet. However, to this day, and that was 6 months ago, folks, and this was sent to us on May 16th, so just a couple weeks ago. However, to this day, we've not received our marriage certificate back. And there's no indication either on my wife's Social Security account or mine online that leaking has even taken place. So I have two questions for you. Have you experienced this with your clients? How long is it going to take, or do we actually get our marriage certificate back? And second, is there any visible indication on the Social Security website once the marriage certificate has been received and processed and our accounts linked together? I love your podcast. Keep up the great work. Cheers, George. I'm not sure if we can answer this, but I bet you we have listeners who know some of these questions, Chris.
Yeah, I have some guidance, but I'd like to hear what other people's experiences are, because there's a lot of elements of Social Security we only decipher or understand once we hear how it actually works for people, because there's oftentimes not a written rule that it should happen this way, period. Now, first of all, receiving the marriage certificate back, if you're ever asked to supply documentation for Social Security, you should get those documents back. And typically in the past, I've seen people get them back much sooner than 6 months. 6 months seems excessive, but I think this is part of the bogged down, not enough humans working there, overworked situation that we've got going on with Social Security. I suspect you'll get the marriage certificate back, but who knows at this point? It has been longer than it should have been. I will point out to everyone, before I go to a second question, that the alternative, if it's a document that you, maybe it's hard to replicate, you don't have another version of it, you don't want to lose it, I would personally not mail it into Social Security. Because the alternative always is take it into your Social Security office. The representative there will get what they need from the document and hand it back to you. They don't keep it if you take it into the office. That would be my preference on a valuable document I don't want to lose. I would at this point not send it into Social Security. Now, should it work the way it was described? Yes. Will they like get it back? Probably will. How long? Who knows at this point? If other people have been having delays in the return of their documents, I'd love to hear about it so I can share it with all of you so you know what to expect. Now, as far as, quote, linking your accounts, there's no indication that I'm aware of that on your account, when you look online, that it shows that you're, quote, linked. What they're linking is actually on the back end in the benefit payment system so that they can more easily automatically pay changes in benefits due to events that happen to your spouse. And that is, you mentioned you haven't claimed yet. When you claim, if the accounts are, quote, linked, if they know you're married, they will check at that moment and see if your spouse is owed a spousal offset, maybe an increase in their benefit because you have claimed. If you pass away, either one of you passes away, if they're linked, then the survivor will automatically start to receive the higher benefit without any other action on your part. That's the benefit to having them linked. But there's nothing that I know of where they show, oh, you are linked and name the person. On Social Security, it's always just your personal information, no connection to a spouse, at least what I've seen. Could they have added that? Possibly. So here's another one. Is anyone out there who's married seeing on your SSA.gov profile any indication that you're, quote, linked to your spouse? I suspect no, but I could be wrong, and I will pass on that information if anybody's actually experienced that and can see it on their account.
Is that my cue?
That's your cue.
Excellent. Alrighty, I was just looking for some annuity questions. We got quite a bit. Actually, we already answered that one. All right, let me do another Social Security question because I was just ready to read an annuity question that we already answered.
Oh, okay. Okay. I can burn some time with another Social Security question.
You can burn some time. Great. I always have Social Security questions I can fall back on when someone isn't quite ready. Okay. All right. Gives a whole state hint. We're not going to do that right now, so I'll just jump into this. Okay. So his question. Will Social Security automatically calculate any pay any spousal offset due? Not worded very well, but they're just asking, will Social Security automatically adjust a spousal benefit to the spousal offset? I am unclear whether deemed application for both one's own and one's spousal benefit means that my wife, having started her benefits at age 62, will automatically get a spousal bump up if she's eligible when I start my benefit at age 70 in August of 2025. How do they know if you are married? They bill us for IRMA, so obviously the IRS gets reports of our modified adjusted gross income. I did put a comment in my own online request that my spouse would like to receive any spousal adjustment when due. So here's a bit of background, Chris. They're both 55. So full retirement age for them is 67 and 2 months.
Must have meant both born in 55.
Yes, so the full retirement age is 67 years and 2 months. Against my recommendation, my wife chose to start her benefits at 62 due to health problems.
Yeah, let me correct one thing so I don't forget. If born in 55, their full retirement age would be 66 and 2 months, not 67 and 2 months. So that probably not part of the question, but just wanted to correct that as we go.
Perfect. Against my recommendation, my wife chose to start benefits at 62 due to health problems and her lack of trust in the solvency of the Social Security system. She was told at the time that her benefits, based on her earnings record, was higher than half of my projected PIA, or primary insurance amount, folks. However, I have continued to work, with earnings exceeding the Social Security wage base each year, such that my annually adjusted PIA should now be higher than when we were both age 62. However, I cannot find on the Social Security website or searching on the internet how to confirm my current year PIA, nor how my wife should request a spousal adjustment if she's eligible. I have estimated that she likely will still not have a spousal offset, but I'm not sure. I've reverse engineered all this correctly. Interesting case, Chris. He kind of wants to check and see, and if she's eligible, he doesn't think she is, but if she is eligible, is it going to happen automatically?
Yeah, so there's a couple things going on here. First, The core question, will they automatically pay his wife any spousal offset due? The answer is they should if, related to the question we answered just a few minutes ago, if they're linked at this, you know, if Social Security in their system shows that you are married to each other currently, then the spousal offset will automatically flow to your spouse when you claim, if it's owed. Now, that's the secondary question. How do I confirm whether it's owed or not? If you, through viewing your Social Security earnings record and the information on SSA.gov, when you look there, if you are having trouble determining your current PIA, what I would recommend is go to one of the free calculators that you can put in your earnings record. You can copy it right out of your Social Security online account, your SSA.gov account. You click on the link. I think it's just called earnings record. And you can put that into any number of free calculators and it'll tell you your current PIA. So that way you would know. You can kind of verify what you called your reverse engineering on there. What they don't put on there when you have, if you're younger than your full retirement age, you can understand your PIA by looking at the benefit estimate at your full retirement age. So if he was under 66 and 2 months and looked at his account, looked at his statement, there would have been an estimate for claiming at 66 and 2 months. And that would be the current PIA. Or if you're a ways away, it's a forecasted or predicted PIA. But if you're fairly close to that date, it's going to be very accurate. once you're past that date, they're not going to tell you if you had claimed in the past back at 66 and 2 months, your benefit would be this. They don't think there's any value in telling you what a benefit would have been, you know, that you can't get now because you're past that date, which he's almost 70. So he's well past his full retirement age. So it isn't real obvious on the SSA.gov website what his current PIA is, which is going to matter for determining the spousal offset. The simplest way is if once you claim, it'll happen automatically. But if you want to check it ahead of time, you just need to reach out to Social Security and they can tell you. They can actually literally pull up either someone at their office or on the phone, pull up your current PIA if you don't want to plug in your earnings record into one of these calculators. That's probably the quickest because customer service at Social Security right now is a little bit hit or miss. So I would probably use that as my first choice, do a calculation with a trustworthy calculator on your own. Or you can reach out to them and they can tell you, just so you know what you expect. Once you do file, if they've got you connected and it's at that point when you file that your wife, to verify she will get her spousal offset, could reach out and proactively ask for it to make sure that they're checking. That's the way to ensure that it's not going to be missed because maybe somehow it's not linked properly that you are married. That's always my concern. If somebody's assuming it's going to happen automatically and then it doesn't because there's a glitch in the system and they don't realize you're married, then you might miss out on some benefits. So I think it's always best to, trust but verify, I guess. Make sure either verify ahead of time that, yes, we show that you're married and it'll automatically happen, or reach out proactively. And once you claim, she puts in a claim simultaneously for spousal benefits in order to, kind of kick them in the pants and make sure that they process it. Now, it probably be worth checking if she's even owed one before you waste the time doing that. Cause it sounds to me like if back when you were 62, they were saying her benefit is bigger than half of your projected PIA, the fact that you had earnings beyond that, when they were projecting your PIA, they were assuming you were going to continue working. You mentioned you were continuing to work, which would have raised your PIA. They were already factoring that in because their projection or prediction for you claiming at full retirement age is based on you working up until full retirement age, earning what you had been earning over the past year or two. So that estimate that they gave you, that conclusion that she was not going to get a spousal offset, my guess is probably still true. But again, I just shared with you how you can verify that.
Right. All righty. So now we're going to get into a couple of annuity questions. I know this show is supposed to be an annuity dedicated show, but two Social Security questions and Jacob's question. I don't think we have too much time left, but we will see what we can get through this. Okay. This begins, and this question came in a couple months ago. On your last Q&A show, you discussed the pros and cons of annuitizing a 401k. I thought of another potential downside that I wanted to get your thinking on. Now, I can't remember that Q&A show, but I do vaguely remember talking about someone who was wondering if they should annuitize their 401k or not. So he says, as you mentioned many times on your show, the SECURE Act opened up the door for access to IRA annuity payments above the account owner's RMD to satisfy RMDs, or for those who don't know, required minimum distributions, from other IRAs they may own, because the IRS treats all IRAs as one account. However, it's my understanding that a 401k account do not receive the same treatment, that each account must satisfy its own RMDs. That means that an annuity inside a 401k may be less tax efficient if later in life they cause you to have to take larger RMDs that you otherwise would not have to or need.
Right. That's a good point.
And he makes a very good point. And the reason I wanted to kind of talk about this a little bit is because SECURE Act has changed the math a little bit on annuities, both annuities inside IRAs and annuities inside 401ks. Secure Act 2 specifically gave employers the protections they wanted from lawsuits if they offered annuities inside their 401k. It does not absolve them from their fiduciary duty to find reasonable investments. But if they do all their due diligence and chose an annuity provider, there's still the risk that annuity provider could run into financial hardships and they didn't want to be held responsible. Or a person later says, well, you know, over the past 20 years I've been doing this, and had you bought annuity company B or offered annuity company B, not annuity company A, I would have received more money. They wanted to protect themselves from those very real, maybe justified, but maybe frivolous lawsuits. And Secure gave them that. And you're starting to see more and more providers offering annuities inside 401ks. So I kind of wanted to lead with this question, Chris. So let's take his second aspect, the fact that 401ks cannot be combined. Let's talk about that first before we talk about IRAs and how they can be combined. So what he's saying, and he's right, if you have six 401ks, you must take six separate RMDs. It's one reason we encourage people who work with us to consolidate and simplify their accounts. If we're helping them manage their assets and they have some money in IRAs with us, but multiple dollars or however many dollars in multiple 401ks, we tell them when RMDs begin, you may want to consider consolidating for simplification purposes. So you don't have to take five separate RMDs if you have five separate 401ks. Now, again, because we have a fixed fee schedule when we manage assets, we're paid the same amount of money whether we're helping someone manage $500,000 or $5 million. It's all the same. So we're not making this recommendation for any other reason but simplification. But also, in light of Secure, as this man pointed out, it could make a huge difference in RMDs. Because, yes, you're going to find if you need to buy an annuity, more and more 401ks will be offering them inside their 401k. And maybe if you had multiple 401ks, you decide to annuitize one 401k fully. And it's starting to pay you a lifetime stream of guaranteed income. You cannot, because 401ks cannot be aggregated. Now, it's not to say Congress doesn't change the aggregation rules in the future. But right now, 401ks cannot be aggregated for RMD purposes. So if the 401k that was annuitized is paying more in income than the current net present value of that income stream would be, and subject that net present value to the current RMD rule, if the annuity payment is greater, you are not allowed to use the excess payments from that annuitized 401k to offset RMDs from other 401ks because 401ks cannot be aggregated. So his point is maybe you would want to move them to an IRA. And he's right. And I'll have to agree with him, Chris, here. Because under Secure, and this was Secure 2, oh, no, wait a minute. It was Secure 1. Secure 1 came out with this. It just took them several years to clarify how it was going to be done. And they have, and we've talked about it on previous shows. Under Secure 1, and the IRS has fully blessed it and explained how this is going to happen, under Secure 1, you are allowed to take an annuity that has been annuitized. Chris, is there technically an account balance once you change a noun to the verb? Why don't you explain what we mean there?
Yeah, technically, no. Once you annuitize, there is no balance that belongs to you anymore. You are now receiving the income promise from the contract. So typically, there's not an identifiable account balance to refer to once the annuity is annuitized.
So when you annuitize an annuity inside an IRA, under the old rules, pre-secure, the annuity payment was considered to be the RMD of that annuity and that annuity only. Even though it was in an IRA and you might have had other IRAs, the annuity payment was the RMD for that IRA annuity and that IRA annuity only. Magically, the RMD for that annuity was deemed to be the exact payment you were receiving.
Which removed the need to track an account balance, which is usually what you need to calculate an RMD. That's essentially, it gave them a free pass to have to worry about that by having this rule and made it simple.
Correct. But Congress also realized that's unfair. And Congress is trying to encourage people to annuitize. They too recognize the value of a lifetime stream of guaranteed income. So Congress said, hey, what you can do with an annuity that has been annuitized is get the current value of the lump sum value of that remaining annuity stream of income. They said in Secure One that until the IRS releases guidance on how to do that, we'll let you use any reasonable method to value your annuity, which really opened the door for a lot of unique valuation methods, because obviously you wanted to value it as low a price as possible to have as big an excess amount and use that to offset other RMDs. IRS came out in July of last year and said, hey, here's how you're going to do it. You have to go to the exact annuity provider you have. And if they have the current single premium immediate annuity that you have, if they still offer it, just have them give you a new annuity quote for your current age. So it's got to be the same one from the same insurance company. You get that quote, we'll allow that as the current value of the income stream, which makes sense. If you're receiving $10,000 a year and you bought it when you were 70, but you're now 78, and that annuity is still available, they still have single premium annuities at that insurance company, you go on their website, you could probably get a quote from the website, you don't have to call them, go to the website, just put your current age in. I'm 78, and I'm receiving $10,000 a year for the rest of my life. How much do I need to put in to get that from you, Mr. Insurance Company? They're going to give you a lump sum. They're going to say, hey, give us, I'm just making this number up, $170,000. The IRS will allow you to say, hey, for RMD purposes, my annuity is worth $170,000. If the insurance company no longer offers that single premium immediate annuity, then you have to go to the insurance company and ask them to give you an account balance based on the interpolated annuity value. You have to have the insurance company do it. And if the insurance company fails to do it, the IRS says you, even though this is allowed, cannot do it. Because you have to value the lump sum stream of income one of these two ways, and that's it. Do not fear, people. Every insurance company will provide you that value. I fully believe it, because if they don't, they know they'll never sell these annuities. So they'll get it for you. The IRS is just trying to keep it simple by allowing you to get a quote yourself on their website if they still offer SPIAs. Make it a little more difficult if they don't, but not make it too difficult where you don't get this benefit. So the benefit is, let's just say it is $170,000, and let's just say the RMD for this person of $170,000 would have been, I'm just making this number up, $12,000. I'm just making that up. That if somebody at that age Chris could actually get the divisor for 78-year-old. But anyways, if somebody who is 78 years old and has $170,000, the RMD is $13,000. If the annuity is paying $20,000, that's more. And they are allowed now to use that extra $7,000 of annuity payment to offset other RMDs. So you don't have to take them if you don't need them. And it allows the money to stay in the IRA and continue to grow, maybe be used for long-term care expenses later, which could be withdrawn tax-free because of the healthcare deduction. So there's a lot of benefits to this annuitization now that we didn't have. But it only applies to IRAs because only IRAs can be aggregated, not to 401ks. So this man makes a very good point. Unless Congress changes the law in the future, it would make more sense to annuitize inside an IRA because of the aggregation rule. Now, one thing I will say, one of the things that Secure mandated with annuities is that they be allowed to be moved from the 401k to an IRA. So if you are still in the accumulation phase and you want to buy an annuity inside your 401k, because maybe it's a good one and it has a good growth pattern or a good living benefit or whatever the case may be, depending on what kind of annuity you're looking at buying, you don't necessarily have stuck with annuitizing it at the 401k. You can move it to an IRA. The insurance company has to allow the annuity to be moved to an IRA. So they don't want to lock you into just being at the 401k. So I still would encourage you, though, as this listener said, you can still buy it in the 401k. And if you really like the 401k, leave all your money at the 401k. But when it's time to annuitize, move the annuity to an IRA and then annuitize. If you want to leave the other money in the 401k, go ahead. But at least get that benefit of being able to aggregate for RMD purposes inside an IRA. Pretty good question. What do you think?
Yeah, no, that was good. Good point he made.
Okay. Time for one more short one?
Yes.
Okay. This one is going to be a matter of opinion. Chris may totally have a different opinion than me. It begins. Annuity question for Annuity Awareness Month. And this came in a couple of days ago. We're going to skip the state question right now. We'll jump to the question. I've heard you and Chris and others talk about how a low percentage of annuities are actually annuitized. Why is that, you think? If you have a deferred income annuity, or DIA, and he put those initials, with an income rider, is turning on the income flows not considered annuitized? If you buy a single premium immediate annuity, your preferred kind, is it considered annuitized as soon as you start taking payments? Thank you for all you do to help teach us do-it-yourselfers about retirement planning. He's got a couple of moving parts here, Chris.
Yeah.
First thing, DIA is different from a DA.
Right.
A DIA is different from a DA. A deferred income annuity is annuitized.
Right, from day one.
From day one. He's using the wrong annuity name, that's all. From day one, when you buy a deferred income annuity, you did a verb. Remember the
same
verb.
Same with a SPIA too, just so to save you time explaining.
Thank you. Same with a SPIA. Both of those annuities, single premium immediate annuity or SPIA, or a deferred income annuity or DIA, have been annuitized. They are the verb. In the case of a single premium immediate annuity, your income payments begin immediate. Single premium, the I stands for immediate. Anytime within 12 months of opening it. Technically 13, because the first month doesn't count. I always say 13, but technically 12. Within 12 months or 13 months of opening it, the income must begin. In a DIA, deferred income annuity, the payments begin after 13 months. Could begin 14 months, could begin 14 years later. You tell the insurance company when you buy it, when you want the income to begin. But both of those have been annuitized. What I think he was talking about was a DA, a deferred annuity. All annuities have an income benefit, but they are not forced upon you until, like I explained on last week's EDU show, or this week's EDU show, the deferred annuities, or all annuities, will have a forced annuitization age at some point in the future. Most new ones are between 100 and 120. Older ones, usually around age 90. I've never seen them. They could be in the 80s, but I don't believe so. I believe most are around 90 to 95. Most new annuities can be around 100 to 121. And they'll force you to annuitize. Prior to that, it's up to you if you want to do it. And most people don't. And he wants to know why. Yep. For a variety of reasons. They don't need to, perhaps. Right. Longevity is no longer an issue. Yep. Or maybe they haven't got to the point in life where they feel they're not following financial concepts. They're still pretty comfortable with withdrawals. They just, for one reason or another, choose not to. But sadly, a lot of DAs, deferred annuities, well, before I go to the sadly part, a lot of deferred annuities are MIGAs, multi-year guaranteed annuities, which have never been purchased for annuitization purposes. They're purchased for principal protection purchases. So they were never bought, Chris, with an intention of ever annuitizing to begin with. But all those annuities are in this statistic you hear of. Most annuities are not annuitized. But it's the other annuities, the deferred annuities with income benefit riders, which we'll get into deeper in another EDU show this month. Most of those annuities are never annuitized because, honestly, they were probably sold and not purchased. And they were sold by advisors, IARs, investment advisor representatives, quote-unquote fiduciaries, who all of a sudden have a come-to-Jesus moment and love these annuities because they can charge their 1% fee on them. Or they were sold by insurance agents who are going to rake in a massive commission up front or a nice trail commission for the life of the product. And they sell it with a lot of smoke and mirrors and misunderstanding, both on their part and the person buying it. And they throw these income rider benefits on there. And they're always telling you, hey, this product, you can get your money out if you want it, or you can turn it into a stream of income if you want. And I know I sound a little flippant on those products because most of them are sold, not purchased, and they're sold for the commission, the trail, which is a form of commission, or now the asset under management fee. So they're going to solve what these people want, which is more income for them, a nice lifetime stream of guaranteed income for them. But they're sold to you under the guise of, you can have your cake and eat it too. You don't need to create the verb that Jim likes. You can keep this a noun. You can get your money out if you want and call the deal off. Or you can turn on an income benefit if you so desire. It's not technically annuitized until the account balance reaches zero. And also what the insurance company is going to do is give you your money from your account. And as long as you don't take out more than what they tell you, you can take out every year. If you live long enough and the account balance reaches zero, the insurance company will pay you from their own pocket. But until the account balance reaches zero, that annuity has not gone from a noun to a verb, listener. It's still considered a noun, even though it's in payout phase. But I would go so far as to argue most of these annuities don't ever enter the payout phase Because when people actually get pushed to shove, they realize they can get a hell of a lot more money in a SPIA than they can from this. I told you, 9 times out of 10, these annuities are going to pay less than a SPIA, but occasionally they will pay more. So I will look at them in some instances as a substitute for a SPIA, just because I think it's my fiduciary duty to look at them. But I do know 9 times out of 10, if not 99 times out of 100, a SPIA is going to pay more. So a long-winded answer to why this is never annuitized, and it's called the annuity puzzle. The industry calls it that. If annuities are so great, why aren't people doing it? There's a variety of reasons why they don't annuitize. Sadly, a lot of it is driven by misunderstanding and the financial advisory desire to have assets under management. And they don't want you putting money in a single premium immediately. Mr. Ken Fisher himself, I hate annuities, so I'll call him out because he runs on that advertisement. I hate annuities, and so should you. He needs to finish that statement because I don't make any money on annuities. I only make money by managing your portfolio. So why would he love them? Of course, he's not going to love them, and he's going to convince you not to love them. Instead, he's going to convince you that he and his firm, charging whatever the hell it is they charge, is a much better option for you so they can continue managing your money and make a management fee off of it. They're going to get a lifetime stream of income. It's just not you getting the lifetime stream of income. They're getting the lifetime stream of income. Did you ever think of it that way, folks? The very people who hate lifetime streams of income want to charge you a lifetime stream of fees. Gee, funny how that works, Chris. How ironic is that? You need to hate annuities because lifetime stream of incomes are bad. But you want to come to me and pay me a lifetime stream of income from your money, and that's good. My firm getting it is good. You getting it, bad. Again, folks, we'll dive into a lot of this over the coming weeks, but the financial services industry and the insurance industry, in my opinion, are after one thing, a share of your money. And you need to understand, these people saying annuities are bad, they want a lifetime stream of guaranteed income from you, but they're telling you a lifetime stream of guaranteed income is bad.
Yeah, there's one last thing I'll point out, too, that I've seen that people need to be aware of, that reasons why annuities don't get annuitized, and that's they're victims of churning, a form of churning, where after the surrender period of the annuity, where there's a penalty period for a lot of these annuities, especially these annuities that pay high commissions to the insurance agents, surprisingly, I'm being facetious there, they'll contact you after the surrender period, after the penalties are gone, when you can now take your money freely, and say, oh, you've got this old stinky annuity. We've got a brand new one that's so much better. We need to put you in that instead. And then they earn another commission and you get another surrender period. So that original annuity never got annuitized because you got resold another one. And that this might happen over and over and over again. So that's something else too. If someone's talking to you, convincing you to move to a new annuity, make sure you totally understand what you're giving up, what you're getting, and that it actually does make sense. Unfortunately, there's a lot of that churning that happens.
Very good point, because you do see that a lot, listener, sadly.
Yeah.
And obviously you don't see it on a SPIA.
No.
But you do see it on these DA annuities, or you don't see them on DIAs either. Those have been annuitized.
Right.
But DAs, deferred annuities, especially by insurance agents who received their commission in one lump sum.
Right.
They're the ones who do most of the churning because they receive most likely 7%. Just so you know, if you buy a commission-based annuity and your insurance agent is going to get an upfront commission, it's about 7% of what you're putting in. But 10 years later, when the penalty period goes away, they're making nothing on this annuity anymore. So magically, the bad ones, I'm not saying they all do this, but magically they found, here's a better one for you. I'd have put you in this one years ago if I could have, but now it's here. It's magic. You probably won't hear from the insurance agent for the first 9 years if there's a 10-year penalty period. And then magically in year 10, they're getting a hold of you because their software system is telling you or telling them this annuity's matured. And then they're going to sell you another one so they get another upfront commission. you see churning less when the insurance agent could choose to receive his or her commission through a steady stream of income. They call that a trail commission. And it's usually 1%. Go figure, huh? That magical 1%. And instead of getting 7% up front, they get 1% a year forever. And they're less inclined to churn. And that's very similar to investment advisors now and investment advisor representatives who for years hated annuities. A lot of them are starting to wake up and love annuities because now the government allows investment advisors, of which Chris and I are. I have a registered investment advisory firm and we're investment advisory representatives of it. So this isn't sour grapes. But all of a sudden, these people who hated annuities are starting to love annuities because they can start to charge their AUM fee on it. Magic how that works. Now that they can, I'm waiting for Ken Fisher to come out with the, I love annuities. What was I thinking? I don't know if he's ever going to cross that realm and start putting his client money in these types of annuities that he can charge on. But again, you just watch the industry, folks. The fee structure of annuities still pisses me off the most. SPIAs, we make about 1% on them. One-time deal. Sometimes two. Sometimes three. I've never seen more than three. And it's a one-time deal. And most SPIAs are sold via commission. Why? I asked the insurance company rep once, why are these being sold by commission? Investment advisors won't sell them. They can't charge an AUM fee on them. There's no incentive for us to have these done any other way. So these insurance products, SPIAs, pay about 1, 2, or 3%, and it varies on the age of the person buying it, if it's for one life or two, period certain. It's just all these little variables that go into it. When we sell one of these annuities, the wholesalers that we use, I have specific instructions for them not to tell me how much any annuity that they're giving me a quote on pays my firm. I don't want to know. Not that I trust our firm implicitly or explicitly. Not that we would ever say, oh, this one pays us more. Let's put clients in that. We would never do that. But I don't want to even know what we're going to pay. We tell a client we're going to get a commission and they often ask us, what are you going to get? I'll tell you afterwards. I have no idea. I don't want to know. I don't want to know. I want to recommend an annuity that I feel, single premium annuity, that I feel is going to be the best one for you. Let's try to find the best A++ carrier we can, and let's choose the one that pays the most money. And I could give a damn what it pays me. But it's going to be between 1% and 3%, just so you know. Okay. But 1% to 3% once, Chris, is a hell of a lot less money than 1% or more forever. And that's another reason you don't see too many single premium immediate annuities being recommended. They don't pay much, and they shouldn't. What the hell am I doing? I'm going to do all the work initially. Should pay anything, and they don't. Right. But it's why a lot of advisors hate them. Why would they want to recommend? Why would I want to take money out of my pocket? Anyways, that's my answer.
Okay. Great. Well, that'll have to bring us to the end of this show. So we'll have some more Q&A shows with the opportunity to answer annuity questions coming up the rest of this month. We really appreciate you sending in questions. If you want to send in your own questions, send them to Jim directly. Jim@jimhelps.com is the email address. That's jimhelps.com. Make sure you put in the subject line of that email. It's an annuity question, if that's indeed what it is. If it's another question, just say it's a question for the podcast. But if you want to get our attention for an annuity question this month, put annuity question in the subject line. Give us enough information to be able to answer the question intelligently, but don't get too carried away with detail, because if it's too lengthy and unique just to you, then it might not be appropriate for us to answer. So just a little tip on increasing your odds of having your question dealt with on the show. Yeah, I guess that's all I have to say. So, Jim, thanks a lot. And everyone take care, and we'll be back with you next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.